Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
What's up, everybody? You're once again tuned in to the show on the road. I'm Zach Lupitin, and we're going to be diving into the second part of my conversation with Zach Goody, the new lead singer and frontman of the band Smash Mouth. Now, you may think you know all about this band from the 90s that had crazy hits like All Star and Walking on the Sun, but on this part of the talk, we actually dive into Zach's life as a rock and roll lifer, and man, he has been on quite the ride. Zach has endured decades of playing in bands to half-empty rooms. Man, he is enjoying a little bit of that spotlight these days.
Honestly, I've been playing with Smash Mouth for a year now, and it sounds cocky or not, but we haven't had a bad show yet, knock on wood, in terms of like, we're in the middle of nowhere in like, you know, Virginia or Kentucky or something, and it's like the so-and-so, you know, the Clam Diggers Fair or some random event, and it's just like, 10,000 people are all there dressed up with Shrek costumes and throwing videotapes on stage to sign. And like, just, it's awesome. It's been, so that's like, I think the best one though, was a couple weeks ago. We played in Monterrey, Mexico, on this festival. And we were the surprise guests. So we couldn't tell anybody, but we were allowed to like hint about it. So we had to like go there, like hide backstage. Like we arrived a day early. I wanted to go to the show and see 21 Pilots. And the promoter was like, you can't go, you're too well known. I'm like, no one knows who I am, I'm the new guy. But so we couldn't go to the show. We had to hide backstage. And then the band plays before us. And it's literally a 75,000 people. I mean, it's literally 70. It's crazy. And we go out there, and it's all dark, and they just do a countdown. They're like, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And it goes, ksh, and the big jumbotron says, Smash Mouth. And we come on stage and do two songs only. I'm a Believer in All-Star. And the crowd just goes ballistic, you know? So
who knew that Smash Mouth would be so big in Mexico?
Yeah. Mexico. We did Peru, too. We did Lima, Peru.
Did you sing Smash Mouth hits in Spanish at all on those tours?
No, but I did. All my banter was in Espanol, in living in San Diego for 20 years really helped me out. I know you're working for the CIA.
They wouldn't have you in the mafia. Now, I understand that the music of Smash Mouth may not be for everybody, but when I was about 12 or 13, I had a cassette of Astro Lounge, and I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever heard. Now, maybe this music won't be around in 20 or 30 years. But you know what? When Zach is out there on those stages from Peru to Mexico to all around the United States, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people are singing every word to these songs. Something about this music is lasting. And after this conversation, I had this revelation that as a songwriter, I just want my music to be there when I'm gone. So let's get vulnerable. Here we go. The most nervous I think I've been at a show was when we did our live record, most of it is live, at the Troubadour.
Oh, wow.
In 2015, I want to say. It was the first time we booked the Troubadour, so it was an exciting moment for us. It was sold out, and, you know, I had friends and family there, and I just botched the first few songs.
Oh, really?
Like, and thankfully we did the recording twice. We also recorded in San Francisco.
So you can fly some stuff.
And
over
I didn't realize that you could sweeten vocals and stuff later on. But like, I just found I was like clenching my guitar, like white knuckle style. Like,
yeah, recording
like
live.
You know these songs.
Recording live is definitely more of a, but look at some of the, like, maybe one of my favorite live albums ever, The Song Remains the Same. I mean, read the website about that one. I mean, literally they plugged in so much stuff that they replaced. Like, it's not even a live album. I never knew that as a kid. Like, I used to watch that movie over and over. They literally had to build an entire set to match Madison Square Garden back in England, like, a year later, have John Paul Jones wear a wig to match it and, like, recreate all the stuff. So half the movie is staged. And, like, all these punch-ins and, like, overdubs. It's crazy. The raw live footage is not what you hear on the album. So even the best do it, you know?
Yeah, I think a great live record is almost a lost art, because you have to account for the audience energy and sound too.
Well, you got to remember to mic the audience. That's important. Right.
That's actually, I think, one of the things that I was not happy about of our record. And you can hear the audience, but it was almost so well recorded that some of the energy of the audience is not there enough, you know? And
well, sometimes you hear a live song that you don't know is live, like someone like someone like Paul Simon or like Simon and Garfunkel, and like you hear a song, and which is also one of my favorite, the concert in Central Park is I love that album, that movie, but like they'll play a song or it'll be on Spotify or the radio, and then at the end people start clapping like that was live.
Yeah,
it's like all this intricate finger picking or harmonies, and you're like, wow, that's impressive, you know.
A lot of the Allman Brothers stuff that I grew up listening to with my dad. It's like, how can you play that perfect at, you know, live at the Fillmore East? It's like pristine.
The Zappa Live at the Fillmore 71 is another live album I love, which has the Turtles on it, you know, Flo and Eddie and that whole thing. And that's an amazing. It's all intricate and rehearsed bits and monologues, and it's incredible. The other great live album is the NoFX live album. I heard they suck live. That their in between song banter is like the best live album banter I've ever heard. It's so funny.
We recorded this cover, which you've seen us play live now. This Beatles cover, "Oh Darling," which is one of my all time favorite songs, and we were in Wisconsin recording this single, and we were like, let's just see if we can knock out the Beatles thing pretty much live.
Yeah.
And we thought we could do it like earlier in the evening, and then one thing led to another, and it was like 1 a.m. and the producer's like, are we still gonna try to do this?
That's the one you want to do last.
And we did. And it has a bit of that like unhinged feeling to it, which I like. Like LaShawn is really going for it vocally and kind of like almost
cracking, but not,
you know, losing it. And after about three takes, she was like, yeah, that's it. That's it for me.
That's a fun song to sing.
How do you guys make a Smash Mouth set list? Is it pretty much the same every night or totally changing all the time?
It's mostly the same. It was mostly the same last summer, but right now we're working on this summer and we're going to change it up for this tour. We're trying to add back in a lot, not like three or four of the older songs that people have been asking for. So we're going to mix in a few new ones that we haven't done. We're going to add Underground Sun, which is the single that we just recorded that's going to come out soon. We're going to have a different encore. I mean, the way the short answer is, there's five songs you always have to play.
You always end with All Star?
Pretty much, yeah. I would say yes. You have to play the five hits, and then the rest you can play around with. And then some of it is because of tuning, so like half their songs are E, half are E flat. So they want to group those together for guitar changes. So it's like, oh, let's play this next. Oh, we can't. That one's an E flat. So let's. That's a little bit of a challenge. Underground Sun. The cool thing about it is there's I think five hits, but there's seven recognizable songs. Like anybody off the street would know seven songs. So when usually our sets are 21, 22 songs, about 90 minutes. So every third song is a hit. So that's kind of a gift, a blessing to have, you know, every third song is a
banger. Always fascinated to me when bands put out records that have multiple hits on it is that they just didn't know what was going to rise to the top. So you have songs like on Astro Lounge, Who's There is the opening track.
So that was my very first practice with the band, that was going to be the opening song of the set. So I learned that one, and I'm like, and they're like, well, what's the first song on the first album?
Yeah.
First album or second album?
This is Astro Lounge.
So first song on the second album, and it has like the spaceship intro, blah blah blah. And so I learned the song and I'm like, guys, you're setting me up for failure. This song is like, it's kind of a slower tempo. It has a lot of words and it's hard to sing, and it's not an instantly recognizable smash hit. You know what I mean?
But at the time, the band, the label was like, this is the song we lead. Lead song is important.
It's a cool song, too. But like, so we changed it to Can't Get Enough of You, Baby, and that's just more of like a...
Which
just
is actually
out.
The last track
Interesting.
Of the record.
Interesting.
And Then the Morning Comes is like 9 songs in.
Wow. That was a number two hit.
That's what's so funny is that songs that... At the time, you're like, yeah, we don't need that anywhere near the top of the record. Like, really? That song is a freaking classic.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at some of the Beatles. look at some of the Beatles B-sides, you know? I mean, Rain is the, you know, Paperback Writer B-side. Probably the coolest bass line of all time.
Like, sometimes, like, I'm working on a song right now with LaShawn, our singer. We put it up on Instagram, and I'm just like, I've never been more certain that I'm like, this song is gonna do something.
Was it the new one you played at the Troubadour last
week? No, this is like a very new song. It's like very sad and very intense.
Yeah, I saw
it. I put it on Instagram. Yeah. But it's almost like I'm so invested now that I'm like, it probably won't.
I mean, who knows? I mean, a band like yours that has such a cool career touring and stuff, like, is it possible to have a hit anymore with a band like that?
I mean, a hit for us would be like being
on some
cool playlist so it gets millions of streams,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Like the most streamed song of ours by a large margin is this very sad kind of car crash folk ballad that got put on all these folk playlists and coffee house playlists.
That's the way to do it now.
And we haven't played it in years. Right. It's almost like it's too heavy in a set, and I love heavy songs.
Dude, I went to your Troubadour show a couple weeks ago, and you guys did that new that abortion song. That was like that was heavy.
I know, but that's like fiery heavy.
It was great. That was great.
Other one is just like heart wrenching. You know,
sad dad.
Well, but then again, it's like that's what I think a lot of people used to love about country music or the blues. It's like stuff talking about really heavy stuff that makes you feel better in some way, you know?
I mean, that's my main genre that I listen to, you know, Ray LaMontagne and, you know, Dawes and, you know, all that kind of like sad Americana type of vibe is like Ryan Adams and, you know, all that stuff is right up my alley. Which is probably why I like your band.
I'm just having trouble recently constructing set lists for our live shows because I'm like, okay.
We need a fast one.
It's a fun show with the horns.
Yeah.
And yet, a lot of our most listened to songs or songs that are most sort of fun to sing for me and LaShawn are like very slow, dark.
Well, I think, I mean, your set list was awesome. The way it was paced with the acoustic sort of like, you know, that whole thing was great. So people seem to respond to it. So keep doing what you're doing.
But like, I just don't know how, I think, you know, in a way the Beatles are a model, I think, for me, because they have so many different types of songs that feel like they're from different planets, and yet it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, like, In My Life next to Paperback Writer, like, how is that the same band?
Yeah.
And it is.
I mean, just look at the White Album. Just look at the side one of the White Album. I mean, just, you know, it runs Blackbird to, you know, back in the USSR.
Did your parents play music growing up, or did they just sort of listen a lot at home? Or?
Yeah, they weren't in bands or anything. My mom was kind of like, she was into like the whole, she was like a flamenco dancer, or not professionally, but that was like her thing before I was born. So she was like into like that kind of music. She wasn't big in the music scene. My dad was super into music. He was like, you know, super into jazz, but he schooled me on all kinds of jazz. Billie Holiday and all that stuff, but he had a lot of records, so I had an older brother, so that was, you know, I got like the Beatles albums and Cat Stevens and ELO. That was like my first three that I just like just on repeat when I was a kid. Cat Stevens, ELO, and Beatles. So I had all those records, still have all the same those records. And then my brother was older, so he turned me on to all the cool stuff, you know, when I was pretty young. I mean, he was into like Brian Eno and the Bad Brains and Devo and, you know, Pear Ubu and Tuxedo Moon and Wire and like all these like post-punk bands and stuff. So I got turned on to that stuff pretty early, mostly from him because he was 4 years older and we were in New York City. So he was going, I was a little bit too young to go out, but he was going to all these shows, going to Danceteria every night and like seeing the Beastie Boys and Bad Brains and all these New York bands. And, you know, then we went to Europe when I was 15, and he bought me the first Clash cassette and Iggy and the Stooges' Raw Power and Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, Brian Eno. Those were like three albums that were super early influential to me. And then that led to Elvis Costello, which was still one of my big all-time favorites, major influence. And then that kind of went in. Then I discovered Devo. That was like Devo was a major part of my childhood. I discovered them when I was like 10, and when Beautiful World came out, and I just got like so obsessed with them. Points to Devo tattoo.
His left arm, folks.
I was super obsessed with Devo for a long time, and that was sort of like they were my Kiss, you know, because like at the time it was the early 80s, everyone was super into like Def Leppard and Ozzy, and I didn't get the whole, I thought it was like corny, the whole metal thing, just wasn't like my thing. And so I was just super into Devo and, you know, got beat up and bullied because back then it's like, you know, it wasn't cool. And then that sort of led to the new wave and punk stuff, you know, the Cars and the Clash and the Police and all that kind of stuff. And that was really my stuff for, you know, most of the 80s until I discovered Motley Crue. Then I started growing my hair. Really, 89 was the summer that everything changed. It was Red Hot Chili Peppers and Fishbone and De La Soul and Public Enemy and all these hip-hop bands, and that just kind of changed everything for me. And then that led into 91, which was the whole Lollapalooza, Jane's Addiction, Nirvana, whole, you know, explosion. So that was my musical education in a nutshell.
And when did you start playing in bands?
Oh, I started super young. Like I started doing the theater thing, like I said, really young. I went to performing arts school. I went to acting camp in upstate New York. I did an off-Broadway play when I was 9, kind of got the theater bug, did a bunch of musicals in school. And then around 15, I started singing in a band, like a cover band in high school. And so I did that during high school. So I got a lot of good experience. I'm singing 3 sets a night when I was like 16 years old, you know, doing like Aerosmith and ZZ Top and Zeppelin and Beatles and all kinds of stuff. That was a great experience. And then I moved to Hawaii after high school and tried to find a band there, but I couldn't really get a solid band going. I met this group of guys who were all in a band, and they all had long hair, so we became friends. But they moved away. They're like, oh, we're moving to Tacoma, Washington to go, you know, be in a band. Because, you know, we're in Kona, Hawaii. There's, like, nothing happening there. So they moved away. We stayed in touch. They had a different singer. And then in summer of 91, that's how long ago this was, they called me up and, like, hey, our singer's, like, a total mess, and we kicked him out. Wait, maybe this is a theme in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a show booked, and we had to cancel it. So we're gonna move to San Diego. And, you know, because our bass players grew up there, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I was living in Cape Cod at the time. I was like, I'm it. They sent me a demo and it was great. It was like metal, reggae, like funk, like, you know. And I was super into hip hop at the time. I was like really into like, you know, Mr. Bungle and, you know, Red Hots and things like that. And so I wanted to do something like that, you know, this thing called rap rock, which hadn't been invented yet. And so we kind of merged. I moved to San Diego and we started this band called Ghoulspoon. And that became the thing that I did for the next 10 years. And that was really, really excellent time to be in music, because it turns out that the guys in my band had moved away from Seattle to San Diego. They were only there for a year, and they're like, well, you know, we don't really fit in, the scene's not really happening. That was like September of 91. What albums came out that month? So I went to join them in San Diego, and I was like, have you guys heard this band Nirvana? And they're like, those were our neighbors. Like, we literally had a show booked with them and we had to cancel it because our singer flaked out, you know. So it was crazy, they moved away from Seattle just when the grunge thing happened. But fortunately we moved to San Diego, which was the hub of just all this new music. So our whole scene was like, you know, Blink and Unwritten Law and POD and Korn and Deftones and Sublime and, No Doubt and Green Day. And so, all, you know, these guys were all friends of ours, and, you know, we played all these shows, all these bands, like all throughout the early and mid 90s. So it was an amazing time to be in a band. I mean, I have all kinds of great memories and flyers of, like, you know, our band headlining and then, like, Incubus and Blink opening. So it's pretty funny. And we were sort of the one band that never made it. You know, like, everyone else got super rich and famous, and we were the one band that never quite
made it. What happened to Ghoulspoon?
Yeah.
Get tossed. The world about the bad boys, green, but I've been sighted.
It's actually the 30th anniversary of our first album this year, so we might do a reunion show if we can get our act together, but I'm just too busy, and everyone else is in San Diego, so we'll see if that happens.
Yeah, it is interesting how bands can either last or fade out and maybe reform, and they're like these little organisms, you know?
It's crazy. I feel like if you could live long enough to see, if you can wait for 17 years.
Yeah.
It all comes around again, right?
All right. We got a couple more years.
And some of these bands are, you know, some of our friends' bands, like, they're still, I mean, POD, Unwritten Law, Bucko 9, Sprung Monkey, these bands are like legendary San Diego bands, and they're still there 30 years later, still touring. I mean, I just went and saw Unwritten Law at the Roxy last month, and they did a huge Australian tour. They're amazing. They have a new album out. It's like, these bands are still going strong 30 years later. Korn and Deftones used to open for us, and we were like, these guys are going to be huge, and they're playing stadiums 30 years later. They're going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, it's insane. If you stick around long enough, you know, you'll get your due. Look at Circle Jerks doing a victory lap now, you know?
I'm hoping that our group Dust Bowl can stay the course without people getting sort of, I think there's a bit of that taken for granted feeling right now where we're just like, yeah, we'll see them again when they come through, you know, they play here once or twice a year. It's like, so if we disappeared for like 5 years and then came back, everyone would be like, oh, cool. But like, it's like also your job.
Right.
So you can't like just, you know, stop doing it. And we love doing it. You know?
Yeah, it's a rough balance to have. I mean, I'm in a completely different touring situation than you because we just play these huge like festivals or state fairs, and like they're all, you know, we fly there. So we're not like, you know, we fly there, we play one or two or three shows, then fly home. And it's a total grind because I don't think it's any easier necessarily than being on a tour bus or in a tour van, because you're constantly on an airplane, constantly in the airport, in a hotel, missing home, missing your kids, whatever. But it's a different world than I've ever toured or been, you know, been used to. It's like
you
get treated very well when you're you know, it's like everything on your rider is there plus more.
What is the weirdest thing on the Smash Mouth rider?
I don't think there's anything.
What did you request?
Well, there was a couple things that I think Steve had from the old rider, which was like a loaf of like a baguette, a jar of peanut butter, and a block of cheddar cheese. and like when we started like last summer before the first shows, they sent it around to the band like, hey, anything you guys want to take off or add, whatever, to the rider. And one of the guys is like, yeah, we could probably take off the baguette and the entire jar of peanut butter. Like, we're only there for 2 hours. Like, how much peanut butter could we eat?
All of it.
So all I added was Ricola cough drops, just to have.
We played this little town in Wisconsin called Viroqua. That has this cool theater. And one of my oldest friends from kindergarten, who I've kept up with, is a chef in this town. And she's been trying to get us to come play this theater for years. And I was like, hey, looks like we're actually doing it.
Was that the night you lost your voice when you're talking?
No, this is in Wisconsin probably 8 months ago. And she has this really cool Mediterranean-inspired farm-to-table restaurant down the street.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, I'm going to make a little something for you guys when you show up. Something out of
like an Iranian wedding or something.
It was like a Persian funeral feast or something. You know, you're like, how can there be this many types of dip?
It's like 20 minutes before showtime, so you can't eat any of it.
We were like, we just like stood in like stunned silence, like looking at it for 5 minutes.
Wow.
There's like 9 different types of olives.
Yeah, those times are nice. Like, we've had a couple definitely like high profile VIP type of situations. Like, we played for the Tampa Bay Lightning, or was it the Orioles? Yeah, Tampa Bay Lightning, and we got to like, you know, watch the game, and we got to ring the or light the Tesla coil. I guess if you're a hockey fan, that's a thing. Like, they have a huge Tesla coil in the Tampa Bay Arena, and before the game, like Tampa Bay, and the switch goes on, and it's like, zzz. So we got to like be on ESPN and do that, and then like watch the game from like the owner's box or whatever. And the layout was just like stupid, you know. It's just like everything. Do you want sushi or do you want pizza? You know, and then. Same thing, we played Camden Yards last summer. We played after the Orioles game, and it was like their whatever anniversary. So all the players were there, and like all the Hall of Fame players or whatever. And it was like 40,000 people. You know, it was like the concert directly after their thing. They built a stage. It's like the Super Bowl halftime. They wheel the stage out right after.
Yeah.
You play your half-hour set, and it was like us, Spinderella from Salt and Peppa, and Drew Hill. Is that his name? Yeah, Pony.
My Pony.
Yeah. What's that? what's the singer's name? Sisko.
Yeah.
Sisko and Drew Hill. It's like random 90s lineup. But those are the surreal situations we find ourselves in.
Well, the 90s are now like beloved music that like a lot of people grew up with. All these people are, you know, able to spend real money in the marketplace. And I think like it's funny that nostalgia, I guess, has always been big money, but K-Earth 101's playing Green Day as like classic rock.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's
dad music, it was punk rock rebel music when we were young.
Yeah, the Clash is on you know, the Clash is on classic rock stations now. It's a trip. I mean, then and now there's not just 90s, now there's 2000s nostalgia for like the boy band era. Like that wasn't cool for a while, and now it's like they're as big as ever. They're back. Backstreet's back. All right.
What is a Smash Mouth song that you feel like should get more attention and love?
There's a couple. I mean, I think we play the favorites. I mean, there's Digging Your Scene is a great one. I think that was a hit, but that's like a kind of a centerpiece of our show. And we kind of incorporate the drum solo into that part of the song. So it's kind of like the centerpiece of our set. Tell me why we're all blood is for pain. The girl is totally insane. She doesn't know the meaning of tame. Still I can't put out the flame. And then I think like the main fan favorite that we've done a couple times, but is pretty challenging to play live, but it's awesome song, is called Padrino. That's off of the first album, and it's like their Bohemian Rhapsody. It's like a punk. Okay. It's like four long verses, tempo changes, double time. It's like a crazy song, and we did it a few times. And you see in the comments section, like, well, you guys gotta play Padrino, but it has this long guitar intro, like this whole like Spanish guitar intro, and Sean, the guitar player, is like, just let me know if we're gonna play Padrino because I need to practice it, you know, because he's like, I'll relearn it, and then we don't play it for 6 months and I forget it again. I have to sit there, you know, it's a hard one to pull off live.
Go in your career as a touring musician on the road, making your way from the crappiest empty bars to stadiums filled with 70,000 people, what do you think was your worst, most painful show?
There's so many bad ones. I mean, dude, being in a band for 20 years in the 90s and, you know, having to, you know, We played, you know, in Merced and El Centro, all these crazy towns in California where, you know, we had guns pulled on us. That was probably the scariest one. We were in like El Centro and like playing some party, and some locals just pulled a gun. They're like, "We're gonna use your gear," and I'm like, "Okay." And we just like packed up our shit and like ran. That was super sketchy.
What were they pulling the gun?
I don't
on
even
you
remember.
For?
It was like. I think it was like this super sketchy group of guys, like, can we use your stuff? Yeah. And we're like, no, we got to go. And like, no, we're going to use your stuff. And then like someone talked to him, and then we packed up our stuff and like got out there quick. I've had a gun pulled on me. That was another time at a show in San Diego. Someone who was like adjacent to our group was like, made a joke, like, I'm going to get my GAT. Or like, he said something about GAT. I don't know if he was kidding or something. And the security guy, this huge, like Samoan, like just like, you know, big dude, just comes up with a gun. He's like, who's got, you know, he's like, I open like the back door, like leave. And there's a gun in my face. Who said they're going to get their GAT? And I'm like, nah, wrong guy. Yeah. That's not a good feeling.
Yeah.
Someone got stabbed at one of our shows in Merced one time outside of our show. Oh no, we played the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco and someone got killed out front there too. That was another stabbing.
Jeez.
There's been a few of those, and there's also been so many just like, you know, soul. I'm sure you've had those before too. The soul crushing shows where you drive. We used to play. Remember that place, Paladino's? What was it called? Palomino.
Okay.
It closed in the 90s, but back then it was a high profile. It was like, you know, we got a gig at Palomino. It's on a Tuesday. You know, we got to drive up. So you pack up all your stuff and you go there and there's just literally nobody there. I mean, literally like the sound guy and the bartender. And you're like, I took a day off of work and I, you know, and sleeping on a floor. It's just that kind of stuff. Just, it's obviously the stuff that builds your character, but definitely makes you question your existence when, you know, when you're doing that, the coconut teaser on a Wednesday and you're playing at 12:35 a.m. and the A&R guy was there at 9 o'clock to see Korn and then left 2 hours before you went on stage, you know? So I've had plenty of those character building moments.
Oh man, our band in college in Michigan had, you know, some slot on this frat party festival. It was like, yeah, it goes all night for 2 days. Like, you're on at 2 a.m. It's going to be great. This is actually a really good slot for you. We're like, okay. And we leave our instruments in the back, like, you know, den where everyone's putting their instruments in, and we just, you know, do other stuff and then come back. And we come back for our set. The house is literally dark, empty, and all our instruments are gone.
Oh, my God.
I had a brand new, I played bass at the time, I had a brand new Schecter bass. It was like gold pickups.
Oh, Schecter bass.
And I was like so heartbroken that I had heard, that was right when eBay first came out.
Yeah.
Like 2006 or something. I was like, I hear you can like bid on stuff on eBay and like someone will sell you something for not that much.
Right.
So I just went on eBay and I didn't realize that if you bid on something and you win, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I bid on like 7 bases at the same time, like at 2 a.m., like crying. I was like, and I won like 3 bases. And I was like, oh no.
Did you buy them?
I luckily, one of them was like $50, one was like $200, one was like, you know. Right. And one of them I still have. It was actually an awesome find. It was a PV. Like sanded down, fretless, you know, like solid wood. Like,
but you never got back your gear that was stolen?
No.
That's
long gone. And the other one I gave to Theo Katzman and Wolfpack when we were in college together.
Theo. Oh, really? Yeah, we just went to go see him couple weeks ago. Were you at that show?
I wasn't. I wish I could have gone. But yeah, it's fun. I wonder if he still has that bass.
He is. I got a good picture with him and Mike Viola. He was there too. Who I love as well.
That little crew we had in Ann Arbor was fun.
I didn't know you went to college with them.
They tell you eventually you need to get a real job or like kind of, you know, be serious as an adult, especially when you're a dad, which we both are now. Then you realize, like, am I actually qualified to do anything else?
The eternal question.
I mean, how have you weathered the storm of obviously being in a much bigger outfit and having more time away. And I know, you know, you were going through something in your marriage. I mean, the highs and lows of this are extreme, you know?
Yeah. It's rough, man. It's, you know, it's a blessing and it's one of those things where I knew it would be hard. But the opportunity came up and I had to go for it. And for it to happen to me at this age too, after I've been through so much, I just feel like, It doesn't happen in life, you know? So it's like this opportunity came along, I just had to go for it. And I have sacrificed a lot, and the travel is hard. You know, you figure for every show you play, there's 3 travel days. So, I mean, it's being gone, you know, if you play 50 shows a year, you're gone half the year. You know, so you're not doing it in 1 month and being done with it. It's like just sprinkled out over 6 months. And
then,
you know, so it's like you're constantly leaving and coming back. It's hard, man. It's hard to maintain relationships. It's hard on the kids. But there's also so many, you know, benefits. It does outweigh it. You know, if it starts to suck, I won't do it anymore. I could always quit or, you know, die or get fired. But it's just I had to go for it and see what. Otherwise, I would be sitting here, you know, watching some other guy do this and being like, that could have been me. You know, you only live once. You kind of have to just embrace it. But yeah, it's definitely, like they say, you know, it's a cliche, but they pay you for the travel, you know, and the show parts are fun, you know. Usually, I mean, depending on what level band you're at, we've had a lot of.
Have your kids come out to any of the shows?
Yeah, they came to a few. They came to San Diego. We did this Surf Girl Pro thing, which was amazing in Oceanside, and it was like I lived there for years, so it's like a lot of my hometown friends showed up, and the kids got to see me do that, and then like get mobbed. It was like this crazy talk about a rock star moment. That was like the way the Oceanside Pier is. There's like an amphitheater like on the pier, so we played this, you know, this big crowd, and then. To get back to our hotel, our green room, which is up the stairs, right behind the Top Gun house, actually, that has the Top Gun motorcycle and stuff. You have to walk on the like beach boardwalk and then up this long stairs and across the street on PCH, wherever it is. And so I was wearing this bright yellow Padres jersey. And so I should have changed my shirt, but everyone just, can I get a selfie? And I'm holding my kids' hands, like, you know, on the board, like running. Like, it's like Hard Day's Night style. It was so crazy. That was almost scary, actually, for a minute.
You could book your own festival, fantasy festival, five acts, dead or alive.
Dead or alive, Jesus.
Who do you book first?
Oh, my God.
And where would it take place?
In the summertime in Cape Cod on the beach.
Okay.
Oh my God, dead or alive? I don't know. I've seen pretty much everybody that's alive to see. I mean, I've seen every classic rock band pretty much out there. So there's nobody left on my bucket list. But I mean, I've never seen Zeppelin. So I mean, Zeppelin's definitely on there. I mean, obviously Beatles and Zeppelin. Maybe Pink Floyd. I've seen them a couple times though. Queen. I've seen Queen with Adam Lambert. It was awesome.
Yeah, but I'd like to see that.
He's great. Flaming Lips, they never disappoint. Gwar.
Still going strong.
Still going strong. Another one that nobody cares if you replace all the members because you can't see who they are. How's that for a lineup?
Yeah.
Zeppelin, Gwar, Flaming Lips, maybe Sex Pistols. Maybe Iggy Pop. I don't know, man. That's too hard.
He was just at the Regent.
I know. It was a Monday. It was just a weird night. I almost went, but I just couldn't motivate to get down there. I've actually never seen him. He's one of the ones on my bucket list. I didn't go to the reunion tour of the Stooges because I'm like, oh, the Stooges, they're old. Now, all of a sudden, that was 20 years ago. And it was like, you know, should have seen him then. Crazy. He's still going strong, though.
Like, will Smash Mouth be touring in 2050?
2050? Probably. I mean, I think the smart thing, like we discussed earlier, is to replace yourself. I mean, I think Kiss will 100% replace themselves and franchise their own band. I mean, why not? You know? I think a band like maybe Aerosmith, it would be a lot harder because, you know, Steven Tyler is such a unique personality.
Right.
But a band like Smash Mouth, I think, you know, just the fact that people don't seem to really have any issue with me being the new guy, I think there could be another new guy. Sure, why not? Maybe my kid will do it. And I'll just like, yeah, kick back and, you know, cash his checks. But there's no reason why they shouldn't be touring in 20 years from now. Sure.
Somebody once told me the world is gonna roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed. She was looking kind of dumb with her finger and her thumb in the shape of an L on her forehead.
Well, look, I have a feeling that if you put that song on pretty much anywhere on planet Earth, people would be able to sing along. I don't care what language they speak or understand. A hit is a hit is a hit. And Smash Mouth has been that band for me where you forget about them every 5 or 10 years, and then all of a sudden, a song like Walking on the Sun or Then the Morning Comes comes on the radio, and you're like, wait a second, that is a perfectly crafted pop song. We don't get to decide what the culture loves at the end of the day. And do I wish that my band could have a hit like All Star? Sure. But you know what? Sometimes you live in a different era where people discover you in many different ways. And I'm trying to come to terms with the fact that, you know what? Maybe the music you write is just for a few hundred people, a few thousand people around the world, and it may fade out, never to be heard again. Was the journey worth it? I think so. Anyway, if you want to see Smash Mouth in concert, they're playing all over the place, smashmouth.com. And Zach sings on this new song of theirs. It's called Underground Sun, which we played a little bit in this episode. And if you haven't heard our first part of this talk, go back and check it out. We talk about all the hits and how they came to be and how he was introduced into the band. If you're curious what my group Dust Bowl Revival is up to, well, of course you are. We're heading to Denmark and England at the end of August, and then playing in Rhode Island and in Northern California and in the Midwest and all sorts of places in the fall. Please check it out, dustbowlrevival.com. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are now a part of the Osiris Network. Do me a big favor and leave us a kind review on the Apple Podcasts page. If you have a second, it would help people find this podcast, and we have some really cool episodes coming up, so make sure you are subscribed. Stay safe, stay creative, and we'll see you on the trail.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.